Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Welcome to the Lorehounds One Shots. I'm your host, David. John is not with me today, but I have a very special guest, Ron Dodson. Welcome.
Hey, good to be back, David.
Good to see you again.
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about Mr. and Mrs. Smith, all six episodes. Pretty exciting. We both really enjoyed the show. Just real quick, a couple of housekeeping details up front. If you need to get in touch with us, send us an email to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com. If you're interested in supporting our community, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/lorehounds. And we also have a new system called Supercast that we're starting to use. It's kind of like Patreon, but it's like built more specifically for podcasters. Anyway, you can find those links in the show notes. As well, we'd like to invite you to our Discord server. We've got a great community. We've got a cool mod team. A lot of fun talking about all the different shows. Everybody's real fired up right now for Shogun, which is just released. So we've got special channels set up for all of that. And I think that's about all of the housekeeping stuff. I'll talk a little bit more about the Patreon benefits and some programming notes at the end of the podcast. But otherwise, I think what we'll do is start with our hot takes. And that'll be spoiler free. So if you haven't seen the series yet, but you're curious to hear what our general impressions are, we'll do that. And then maybe we'll have a little break and then we can get into a bit more of a detailed analysis of the season. Ron, yeah, you've got some great bullet points here for our outline. You have said that this show is your current obsession, so I'm excited to hear what you have to think, because I loved this season of television. It was so, so good.
Yeah, this is easily going to be on my top five list.
Cool.
Right now, it's sitting right at number one. It's going to take a lot to
knock it
off the top. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What are some things that we can talk about that are spoiler-free about your... Like if I haven't seen the show,
right?
What would you tell me to get me to watch it?
Yeah, I think the natural place to start is, you know, what is your relationship with the quote unquote source material?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I say quote unquote because I think even the movie was kind of like a remake of an earlier TV show.
Oh, really?
From the 80s or 90s, called Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Scott Bakula.
Oh, God.
So
I have to Google that right now.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that there was something from before.
Yeah. I think most people, including myself, are going to think about the Brangelina movie.
Sure. Yeah.
From the, what was it, 2005 or something like that? When that came out. And, you know, one, have you seen that one? And if so, overall, how do you think it compares?
I have seen the movie, but I will admit that it wasn't, I don't even think I saw it when it first came out in the theaters, because mm-hmm. I was kind of like Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, pass.
Right.
Kind of neither of them are people who really inspired me at that particular time in my life. I've looked back on Brad Pitt's career a little bit more retrospectively, and he's solid. He has delivered a lot of solid entertainment over the years.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And Angelina Jolie has just not been somebody I'm overly interested in following in her, no, I hear her you. Career.
Yeah, I never saw it when it originally came out either. And then I watched it after seeing the TV show with Donald Glover and Maya Erskine. I watched it.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And it did not do anything for me. I was bored. This may be, I don't know how many sacrosanct movie laws I'm breaking by saying this, but I just felt like I wouldn't say it was horrible. And maybe it was a movie of its time.
Mm-hmm. 2005, yeah.
There were times, like the big fight scene they had somewhere in the second act, I believe. I just remember thinking after the fight scene, she had been kicked in the face, kicked in the gut. Her hair was still looking pretty top notch. Her makeup was looking good. And she had like one tiny scratch under her left eye. I'm like, come on. And then at the end, there's this ridiculous shootout where the two of them are in this factory or some type of warehouse surrounded by guys in bulletproof vests and all the gear. They have nothing on. All the other bad guys are missing them.
Even though
they're not behind anything. And in slow motion, they're killing everybody.
Right.
And I was just, maybe because I watched it after seeing this highly superior television show.
Sure, yeah.
It impacted how the movie fell on me.
Right.
So that's for me personally.
Right.
So if you're out there,
it is a beloved film by a lot of people. And I get that. I think it struck a chord at a particular time with a particular set of actors. And it is, it's fantasy violence, right? It's heroic violence where they never, face a real mortal threat because we're there to see them and not anything else. When I heard about the television show and I said, okay, Glover and Erskine, this is not going to be the movie. This is not a reboot. So every time a reviewer I would see online somewhere, they're saying, well, it's certainly not the original movie. I'm like, duh. Are you just playing? Is this what your editors are sort of getting you to say this thing? Because for me, it was never going to be a reboot of the movie. It couldn't have been. Not with Glover at the helm.
And I knew that from the original announcement when it was Glover and Phoebe Waller-Bridge 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
I knew it wasn't going to be the original movie because obviously what was a big draw from that original movie was how beautiful Brad and Angelina were.
Exactly.
And I remember shots.
The birth of Brangelina. Yeah.
Right. And I remember shots of that movie where I'm like, damn, that Brad Pitt's a good... I'm confident enough in my heterosexuality to say that Brad Pitt, if anyone could take me to the other team, Brad Pitt could probably do it. Some of the shots in there. And I think I'm kind of with you with Angelina. Like, she's an attractive woman, but she particularly doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
That's just my particular taste.
Sure, yeah.
That being said, she does look like a Greek goddess in this movie.
Yeah.
So, and that was obviously a huge part of that film.
Right.
Two beautiful people kicking ass. And one thing I like about both Waller-Bridge and Glover as a pairing, as well as Donald and Maya, is that I think all three of them are attractive people.
Mm-hmm.
But they are more of like a down-to-earth attractiveness, a more relatable attractiveness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that kind of stood out to me. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the internet kind of ugliness that came out in terms of this being an interracial couple and not two beautiful white people. We don't need to get into that. But obviously, there was some of that going on.
I've been inside of my bubble and I was in a True Detective bubble. So I was trying to keep my force shields up from all of that toxicity.
Well, True Detective had a little bit of that as well,
But a little bit.
And that was bound to happen. I think anyone who's a fan of Glover, I'm sure Glover knew that was going to happen. But I think the biggest question mark was, how is this going to hold up to this movie that was really beloved by so many people?
Right.
And for all intents and purposes, I don't think this television show, aside for some homages to some of the scenes in the movie, this TV show is not really like the movie.
No, it's the central conceit of a couple as a spy couple. And that's right. It.
That's pretty much it.
You have to cut out everything else from there.
Yeah.
Because in the movie, it was they didn't know each other
exactly.
were spies. Where exactly. this one is, they're paired as spies.
So. Right, right. And that's not, you know, that's a premise from the beginning. So that's not really a spoiler. So,
exactly.
So I like that aspect of it. And so I would say if you're a fan of Glover's work, if you like, I would describe this movie as a romantic dramedy. Mm-hmm. That happens to be about two kick-ass spies.
Right.
And you can debate whether or not they're quote-unquote kick-ass.
Right.
You
know, yes,
you
exactly.
know, you know, one of them is probably a little bit more adept at what they do than the other. They're definitely both talented at what they do as spies. But this isn't too much of a spoiler, but it's established in the first scene that they're kind of rejects.
Right.
From traditional spy organizations like the CIA, FBI, whatever.
Right. And
so we already know that going in, that some aspect of them is talented enough to even apply for an organization like this.
Right. To be considered.
But there's something about them where they didn't make the cut on the varsity. So this is almost like a JV, but maybe not quite. So there's that going into it. And
it's not fantasy violence either.
No, it's not at all.
It's very grounded. It's very down to earth. There are some scenes where they're limited by how far they can chase and how many people they can actually fend off and a number of other things. So it borders on the hyper fantasy violence, but it always stays just inside the line.
Right.
And I think that's a really good thing that separates this from the movie or any other kind of similar shows.
Yeah. I think the other thing I would tell someone going into it is that episode one, if you haven't watched it yet, episode one, I think it's a slow, I don't want to describe it exactly as a slow burn, but it kind of, there's a lot of action in episode one. There's great setup for who they are as a character. There are some scenes where they cut back and forth between like an interview process that they go through with this mysterious organization. I love the editing and how that was done.
Right.
Where you don't hear the question being asked, but you can tell
the answers based on the answers. Yeah. Yeah.
And they start right at the beginning, establishing not only the different characteristics and the different personalities of them by juxtaposing their answers, but even the different histories. Cause you get an idea the kind of relationship they have with their parents. You know, one scene, you know, one of the interview questions, you know, the Maya Erskine character, Jane, says, "Oh, you're going to pay me not to have a relationship with my dad? Where do I start?" Something like this line.
Whereas and Donald, yeah, so you're set up for who she is as a character like, right away.
And Donald Glover's like, he loves his mom. He's close to his mom, which plays almost like a throwaway line in this first scene. In this first episode, but it definitely has a significant meaning later on, even up into the finale. So,
right.
I love that setup.
And the way that they've structured the season as the trajectory of a couple, as the relationship works. And the titles for the episodes are even
like
first date, second date, vacation, double date, do you want kids, couples therapy, naked and afraid.
Right.
Infidelity and a breakup.
Yeah.
And so, it's in many ways, it's the anatomy of a relationship.
Absolutely.
And it just so happens to be, and I love it when a show can do this, is that they can take something mundane that we've seen in a lot of other occasions and a lot of other shows and movies, and then somehow turn it inside out, kind of a Mobius loop style, and suddenly, you know, and change the context, and suddenly what seems mundane becomes imperative, and it drives action, and it really hooks your attention into, like, how are they going to navigate this now? What is this going to mean for the relationship? You know, when stuff happens and they're like, you know, it brings them together or it pushes them apart, and you can then really, I think Fargo did this in a lot of ways as well. And what was the Sam Esmail movie just recently? about the disaster.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Leave the world behind.
Leave the world behind. Right.
Same kind of thing where here's a bunch of normal, mundane human relationship stuff. And then now we're going to wrap it around these really extreme circumstances. And then what does that do? And what can that tell us about our relationships? And I think this is what fiction does great is that we can learn so much more about ourselves and society and our lives by creating these fictional worlds and seeing what happens. But in these cases, these are extremes, right? Mm-hmm. in super extremes. And when a show can pull that off, man, so good. So, so good. And this, the chemistry between Erskine and Glover is so, I don't know how to describe it. I don't know how to put my finger on it. Huh?
I was saying it's palpable.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's weird and it's kind of awkward and I don't know. I don't want to get in trouble for being a generationalist, but it felt very millennial in some ways as well. Mm-hmm. There were some vibes and sort of relationship moves that as a Gen Xer, I'd be like, why are you doing that? That's so weird. But yet it was just they inhabited their roles so well. The acting was sublime in some cases. So
yeah, no, it was great. And I love how you brought up, you were talking about fiction and what fiction does well. I think any genre picture, and I usually use this example when it comes to sci-fi. Like, I feel like the best sci-fi mm-hmm. are the science fiction stories that can illustrate a particular theme or moral brilliantly, profoundly, maybe even provocatively within the genre, and then use that genre to ultimate effect. And I feel like this television show is kind of like that for the spy action thriller.
Yeah, because that's a good point.
Because one, the spy action scenes that happen are off the chain. I feel like particularly the episode when they're in Lake Como, which is the kids episode.
Yep, yep, exactly.
That's the one that has Ron Perlman as the guest star.
well, which we're going to talk about. That's one of our topics is guest stars.
Those shots, the fight scenes that they have, mm-hmm. the different adventures that they go on. I think from a spy action genre piece,
it satisfies.
It totally satisfies. But like I was saying earlier, I wouldn't call it a spy action TV show. It's a romantic dramedy, mm-hmm. And that is just set in a spy action genre movie. And the relationships between these two, it's real, it's authentic. I think the most common criticism I've heard is how fast they kind of develop.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Because it's pretty much by episode two, they're locked in. And my response to that is, well, one, I think when you throw two people who are attractive into such a situation where things are heightened and they're sharing this heightened experience, it doesn't take much for that to create a bond and connection.
Sure. Yeah.
Especially a sexual one, right?
Right.
And I think that's kind of what...
Especially high risk.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of like the spark to their romantic relationship is a sexual encounter that they have mm-hmm. relatively early from a relationship standpoint. But come on. Who here has not, you know, hit it off with someone on a first date or whatever? On a first date, even, you know, they didn't even hit it off on the first date. It was like the second date,
right?
Literally, in according to the show, before they actually hit it off. So I didn't have an issue with how fast their relationship progressed. And by the next episode, when it's clear that they've had a relationship, because in episode two is when the heat kind of kicks off between them.
Right.
But it isn't to episode three until it's established that they have a relationship. But you don't really have, to my knowledge, if I recall, they don't really make it clear how much time has elapsed between episodes two and three.
Right.
And so it could be a few weeks, as far as we know, where that could have grown and developed. So I didn't have an issue with how fast the relationship grew.
So we should maybe take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll start to work through our outline.
Yeah.
It's available on Amazon Prime, all six episodes, so you can stream it now. So if you haven't seen it yet, definitely put it in your rotation. But then when we come back from our break, we'll get into it.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
And we are back. Okay, Ron, let's start to work through your outline here that you put together, because you said this show is your obsession. So I want to follow you down this rabbit hole a little bit.
And earlier, before the break, you said there were six episodes. There are eight episodes.
Oh, my apologies. Thanks for catching that. I'm in episode stew right now. We just finished True Detective.
I bet.
Just starting to...
You guys are covering a lot.
Shogun, yeah. And then, of course, you know, all the other stuff that, you know, trying to watch on the sides and the background and stuff. All right. So your first note here is the evolution of the series. So you want to talk about a little bit about the development and how things rolled through? Because I know that Phoebe Waller-Bridge was originally attached to it, but then separated, and then it went through some more evolution. So,
yeah, I'm not 100% familiar, and I don't even know if it's been revealed yet specifically why Phoebe and Donald decided not to work on it together. But one of the things I just wanted to get your take on was how the show would have been different if it was Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Donald Glover doing it, as opposed to Maya Erskine. And I feel like if you've seen Fleabag, which is has a similar quirkiness to it that Atlanta has in terms of like the kind of comedy and style, which is why I think those two as a pairing made sense from the get-go. And I feel like the show still would have been good, but it would have been, I think, a very different show.
Yeah,
if she was a co-writer, because she would have been like a co-creator or co-writer on it. I think it would have the kind of comedy she does. I think it would just and kind of actress she does. I think it would have come across differently. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Phoebe Waller-Bridge is. I'm looking forward to seeing her more. I don't have a deep connection with her just because I haven't seen that much. She hasn't been that much. I bounced off Fleabag a little bit when it first came out, and that was 2016. So I really wasn't in the same zone as I am now with television. Whereas, you know, if I could get back around to it, I would definitely watch it as a piece of canonical, you know, show. Her energy and her affect is a much bigger personality. And I think it would have changed that where Erskine is a bit more subtle, and she plays that that passive aggressive controlling aspect of her character. It comes off in a much more low key way, and I think that worked really well with who Glover's character was in this.
Where
he's dealing with his own sense of identity and his own sense of, well, you know, being a man, and you know, all of these kinds of things. But he's dealing with anxiety, and is his asthma really that or not? But that's getting more activated by Maya Erskine's, you know, controlling nature and the way that she's sort of always one-upping in a way. So I think with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, I think this is the long way of saying that with her, it would have been a completely different show, because her energy, even if she was playing it down, is still bright and vivacious and energetic. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea where they would have gone with the show. I did hear a little bit that basically the way that Glover and his culture of working, and the way that writers' rooms work, and the way that hey, we all pile in and we're elbowing each other and we're, you know, making practical jokes on each other and laughing and, you know, telling somebody that their idea was crap. When you're saying it in a loving way or in a creative way. So I think it was just a very different creative vibe. And then, so I think from what I heard is that Waller Bridge was like, oh, I don't know if this is my vibe. And so that it was kind of more of an amicable stepping away that this isn't the project for us to be on together.
Yeah. And now that you say that, I think I vaguely remember an interview. I don't know if it with Donald referencing that.
Yeah. That's basically, I think that's where I got it from too.
Yeah. Talking about how his writing room works. And one of the things he talked about was the fact that he and Phoebe are good friends, but they're not necessarily friends like that.
Exactly.
And I think wanting to work with someone, so Francisca Sloan ended up being the show, essentially the co-executive producer, and I think they're like right. the official showrunner, who was one of his collaborators in Atlanta.
Right.
She already had that kind of camaraderie with
and Glover, could roll with it
and yeah. could roll with it, and obviously Stephen Donald's brother was involved as right. as a creative as well. So,
and Hiro Murai, who they worked with a bunch as well. Yes. So he knows how to yep. shoot them and work with them. So totally. Yeah, there's a kind of a little crew there. That's yeah. That's right. yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So yeah, I think that makes sense. I think in the long run, working with the creatives that he worked with and having Maya as the counterpart, it was almost like lightning in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
It just, like you said, there's a je ne sais quoi to their camaraderie that I think comes out both on screen, but like even all the press junket videos that I've seen of them together, right. you get that sense.
And Maya Erskine seems like the kind of actor who's like, oh, what do you want me to do? You want me to like wrap myself in cellophane and, you know, light my hair in fire and, you know, or what? I'm just trying to find some ridiculous right. thing. Like, she's into it.
Yes.
Like, she's like, where do you want to go? Okay, I'm not only going to go there, but I'm going to go further than you thought that you wanted me to go. And she's like in for it. She's ready to act. She's ready to get into, you know, weird stuff. And I think that energy with Glover, I don't even know how to contextualize Donald Glover, mm-hmm. you know, just his vibe. But yeah, they I think it is. I think it is a lightning in a bottle situation.
Yeah. And if you've seen Pin 15, which was one of her, I don't necessarily know if it was a breakout, like it wasn't her first thing or anything, but
that's what everybody references.
Right, right. That is a great example of her. Like, if you've seen her haircut in that TV show, she plays a 13-year-old. The level of vulnerability you have to mm-hmm. get to play some of the scenes she played in that. Similarly, like Fleabag, I think it was only a couple of seasons, and I think people wanted more of it.
Yeah.
But that was a great example of Maya, showing Maya to be the kind of actor who can go to those crazy places and is willing to do that.
I didn't realize that she's the voice of the main character of Blue Eyed Samurai?
Yeah, I think I remember seeing that. And
yeah, I've not watched that all yet. I watched a little bit of it and I was like, I'm not sure this is, you know, something that I wanted to watch, but I don't think I understood. Like, I didn't have a context for
right.
it yet. So
right.
I think I want to go back and check it out. So we've been talking about the chemistry between mm-hmm. Maya and Donald, but maybe we can talk a little bit about the chemistry between
John and Jane.
Mm-hmm. I had to look up their names. I couldn't remember for a second. Then, of course, it's like, wait a minute, they're John and Jane Smith.
right. Again, I thought it was so real. I remember one of the things I tell people is, if you've been in any kind of long-term relationship, mm-hmm. some of the scenes may be triggering in terms of...
so like, totally.
Like in episode... I think it's episode 3 where they go to the Dolomites, the mm-hmm. ski chalet.
Exactly.
They get into a little skirmish about eating styles, and mm-hmm. she makes fun of him like, this is how you eat. My girlfriend and I, she's always teasing me and getting on me about like how I eat.
Right.
And what's funny is because my girlfriend's Chinese. So
mm-hmm.
I remember when I first posted a trailer about this video, about the TV show, like before it came out. And I said, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see this. This is going to be amazing. My best friend and co-host on my podcast, JD, who's always getting on my case.
Right.
He was like, oh, I know why you're excited to see it. And you're like, wink, wink.
Because you're mirroring your life. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I would be lying if I didn't, you know, whenever you see something that looks like you on television mm-hmm. that you don't normally see, it is something that kind of, something you kind of relate to, right?
So, sure. Yeah.
You know, being a black man in a relationship with an Asian woman, there is an aspect of this TV show that kind of spoke to me in that sense. Although, except for one line in the marriage counselor episode, the issue of them being an interracial relationship is not at all really talked about throughout the series.
Right, right.
And there's one line in the finale where she says something along the lines of, I always thought you thought of me as a white girl. Because she's, mm-hmm, I guess, within mm-hmm. the context of the story, she's technically biracial, like her dad is Japanese and her mom is right. white, is the implication right. I got. But so there's that.
But aspect. She's coding white.
Do you think she codes white?
She isn't
physically, she does not look white.
But no, but dress and manner and speak totally, and all of that kind of stuff. When in socials, in the common social space of like a restaurant or something like that.
Absolutely.
She's coding, whether she's being received as white, but she's signaling white anyway, her outward.
Right, right. Which again, in the context of the story, she does not have a good relationship with her Japanese father. So it would make mm-hmm. sense that there's probably an aspect of her that wanted to be cut off from her Japanese-ness in mm-hmm. a sense.
Well, doesn't that drive some of her psychopathy, some of her self-loathing and sort of the way that she then overachieves because of that?
That's an interesting point. I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you're right. Go ahead.
No.
I was going to say they're going back to their chemistry.
Yeah, yeah.
The different arguments they have. I mentioned the food eating thing. Episode.
Ooh, can we? And then the vacation, like when you go on vacation and you make friends with other people in the vacation right. stuff, and yes. she's just like, red flag, no, right. this is not happening.
I don't want a vacation couple friend.
Exactly.
You're not here for that. Why am I on a mission?
I was completely vibing with him. It's like, no, make friends, have, you know, chat with people, you know, be kind. And
which
and
is so much how I am also, right. really. That was another thing that I was relating to, because aside from the racial similarities,
right.
and my girlfriend teases me about how I eat, I am very much sort of like the fun, affable one. And she is too. I'm not saying she's not, but I'm definitely more like the Glover type.
Yeah. And somebody who's leaning forward as opposed to leaning back a little bit.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I am definitely someone who I would say, I don't like to read as much. Mm-hmm. Like I wouldn't say don't, which is ironic because I'm an author and I wrote a book. But right. like, my girlfriend loves to read. She has a bunch of books. And in the TV show, Jane loves to read. And she reads, like she, I think they reference The Prophet.
Yeah.
I think it's mm-hmm. the name of the book.
That's the one.
That's totally the kind of book my girlfriend reads. She reads like these types so of, saying. You know, because she, and so I found that interesting too. But, you know, later on in the series, early, Donald pretends that he's read it. He says it's one of his favorite books.
Yeah, which is a breach of trust in the relationship.
Right. But I love how they dealt with it, because the way it comes up later in that marriage counselor episode where
yes.
it becomes obvious to Jane that he's never read it.
Is that episode 6 there?
Episode 6, yeah.
Yeah.
It becomes obvious to Jane he hasn't read it, and it makes her so upset. And this is another thing that I kind of related to, the context in which he made the line when he said that he did was almost a throwaway. He said it because he was jealous of the hot neighbor, which we should talk about, played by right. Paul Dano. And it was at a time where they were still early. I don't even know if they were technically in a relationship yet.
Uh-huh.
Like maybe he was having feelings for her, but they hadn't really hooked up yet. And so it wasn't like they were in a situation where he had an obligation to be 100% honest with anything, because they are already in a situation where they don't know each other's backgrounds. They don't know each other's real names. They don't really know each other's backgrounds. It's kind of revealed to us early on that they're lying to each other, because at that vacation, they're asking each other about, like, how many people have you killed?
Right. Which is, how many people have you slept with? Right.
It's like the body count. Right. Exactly. And he lies, because the answers they give are different than the ones they gave
to the high
interview in the mysterious organization in the first episode. So we already know they've established the fact that they are both being dishonest with one another.
Right.
So it was odd that when this revelation came up, that Jane would take it so seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that at the time he said that, they weren't that close. It was a totally different thing.
And that's another thing.
That was another thing kind of related to, where you're in a relationship
with someone. The history of the history and context of how things happened in the relationship. And then way out here, she's taking it as a breach of trust, when way back there, the context was,
wasn't there.
We were just bullshitting. Like, we're trying to figure each other out.
And to me, it kind of felt akin, where when a partner gets mad that their partner never told them about, like, some kind of ex or some kind of relationship that they had prior to them being in a relationship, and it comes out later that they had a relationship.
I forgot about,
you know? And so which actually happens in this too, but I don't think she gets as upset about it. But I'm just talking about in general.
Was that the second date one where he meets in the farmer's
market? Right.
And she psychs him out with the...
Right. that was the other thing that I thought, that's another thing, you know, that I kind of related to. So the for reference, in the second date episode, which I think is episode...
second date
four.
Number two.
It was number two.
Yeah, number two. Yeah.
I'm talking about double date. It's the double date.
Oh, double date. Right. Okay.
Are you talking about
the second John and Jane's?
Yes.
Yes. The high risk. The high risk.
Yes. The high risk. So in that episode, that's the episode where John and Jane 1 are shopping at an outside farmer's market or something. Right. And
which I love. Just having moved from New York, it was really great to see all these New York scenes. I was like, I know that market, I know that train, I know that neighborhood, you know, maybe not that specific house, but I know that street. Yeah. So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I thought it was interesting. So that's the episode where they meet one of John's exes.
Right.
And one, I thought it was interesting how she responded, because there was no jealousy, it seemed to be, on her part. But I love the fact that she kind of teases him by saying, oh, I think it's so cool that you didn't mind the fact that she didn't have a hand. And the fact that he couldn't.
and they shot it so well. I was watching the whole episode looking for the hand. And the fact
that he couldn't remember that. I have ADHD, so that happens to me. It's like, wait, did I not do something? They're like, and you could see in his face, he could not remember whether or not she had a hand. And I thought that was a nice little.
But then that goes into her psychology, too, in the same way that she set him up with the laptop.
Right. Remind us about that.
The fake porn.
Right.
So good.
She's playing him so well.
Yeah. And then the cat, right? The cat is this emotional security for her. And of course, that's the thing that, you know, ends up, you know, I'm glad they didn't. Well, anyway, they showed the cat. I mean, it's they broke a rule in the sense of, like, you killed a pet. That's right. But that's one of the triggering things that set them at odds with each other, because that was the one place that she emote and be vulnerable with this cat being, as opposed to, you know, all this trickery and lies and history with her dad and all of the work stuff, you know, that she, you know, that her dishonesty, that when she's trying to pretend to the world that she's, you know, honest.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
All right. So you want to talk a little bit about the relationship issue? Should we segue into the marriage counselor episode? Because that's a real inflection point, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is going to go down as one of the favorites of the season for a lot of people. And I think because it's there's so many layers cinematically, storytelling wise going on. You have this marriage council that they're meeting, played by Sarah Paulson.
Right.
Who's hilarious.
She's so good.
Just she plays.
Please don't play that. Please don't play that.
right.
The piano.
She like the way she plays the sort of white liberal.
Oh my God.
You know, and the way she pronounces these exotic words, like, you know, oh, I got this from Umbaktu. And it's, right. And it's just, it's so funny. And she's like, please don't play that. And all these little, but at the same time, some of the advice she gives as a counselor, having been through enough, you know, counseling, you know, sessions myself, are pretty spot on. She's not a cartoon of a counselor.
Right,
there's aspects of her. It's like she rides that line of being a little bit silly, but not unrealistic.
Right.
In terms of her character. But so you have that. So you have Sarah Paulson threading that needle really well. You have the cinematography and the use of color and the use of blocking. Mm-hmm. Where in the first session, it's bright and warm. They're sitting next to each other. They're touching each other. And by the last session, the tone is cool. They're on opposite ends of the sofa. They're not talking. And I think there are 3 or 4 sessions. So we slowly see this happening. And it's something that's subconscious. I love that.
The way that the tension in the relationship is unfolded by the counseling sessions was a really great device. I didn't notice the tonal lighting stuff, but that's a great pick. Obviously, you pick up on the body language.
Right.
And by the time he's way off in the corner and like spread out and like, oh, you know, not, you know. But it really was a awesome way to drive the story forward by cutting the scenes. And then, of course, when you leave, that's when you have these really weird conversations with your person you're in therapy with. You're like, this is weird. Like, we're just supposed to talk now and like say stuff. And
I actually think that was something because having gone through marriage counseling with my ex, who we had an amicable divorce, and I love the fact that we were able to have one, but we were married for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the sessions that we went through, and I'd been in relationship sessions with past girlfriends, so I have a lot of experience with that kind of thing. And that is one of the interesting aspects of when you go to any kind of counselor are the awkward conversations afterwards where you're processing some of the things that were revealed, what they said. The fact that she was getting the impression that the counselor was being was liking him more, which is again something that comes up sometimes. That sense of it seems like they're on your side versus my side,
right?
Which may or may not necessarily be a reality. It could be in the person's head. So I thought that was interesting. And then the other thing about that episode was it was a good balance between relationship and action. There were some pretty cool action scenes in that series. There was one where Maya is fighting the dude in the elevator.
Oh, I forgot about that. I forgot that was in this one. Yeah.
And she's holding her own. And that's where we see his asthma because he's they're going up the elevator and he's running up the steps and his asthma's kicking in and she's kicking ass with this other dude. And then I think the only other one, there was another scene where they're running. Because they're talking about some scene where they're, and you see them running down the street. There was that. And then there was the scene where this was the episode where they had a little bit of a reference to their interracial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that there may be some type of, I would say, I wouldn't say like stress or strife, but there's some kind of dynamic in terms of, because he references in this one job they're on where he's having to vibe with these other, I don't know, they're drug dealers, whatever, but these 3 other black dudes.
That was an amazing scene.
It was such a cool scene. Because
he's trying to integrate and infiltrate.
Right.
And just be a normal dude.
Yeah.
And he's also being his charming self and right. making people laugh and having a good time. And she's like, I'm over it. Bang.
right.
It was so good.
It was really good. And I thought it was. And so,
oh, and it was, that's right. Because she, because when he started talking about his wife.
Right.
And saying some stuff, that's when she lost her temper with it.
And what's interesting. So I don't know how many people would pick up on this, but. He mentions that he's talking to these black dudes and they're saying like, who's your, you know, who you married to? And right, he says, right. he's in a race relationship. And one of them says, oh, is it Latina? And then he says something along the lines, no, she's Asian. Right. And then he says something along the lines, you know, he mentions that she's Japanese, but he says she could be low key Korean.
Right. Yes.
And
yeah. That's it. That's what
I don't know how many people know this, but there is a sort of enmity between mm-hmm. Japanese people and Korean people. And that obviously that's a generalization, but in terms of right. the,
there's real history there though.
There's real history.
Did you watch Pachinko?
No, but it came up. And have you ever seen, what was that comedy? It was a comedian comedy about a Korean family that own a shop in, mm-hmm. I want to say Toronto.
I don't, just not, it's not ringing a bell. Is it sort of a regular two camera sitcom type thing or?
Right. It's one that Simu Liu was on before he got big.
Okay. It's not ringing a bell, but that doesn't.
Well, anyway, on that show, they touch on that particular topic a lot.
Right. Well, Pachinko goes deep into that thing because it's a Korean family that then is living in Japan and a lot of stuff that goes on there. And that, did you like Station 11? Did you see that?
I didn't finish it.
Okay.
Did that come up in Station 11?
No, it's just I'm talking about like the vibes, the sort of vapors that are just above the surface of a show. And I was getting the same kind of high off of both of those shows, like really soulful, really beautiful, really deeply moving. And that's a particular favorite of mine is when a show can sort of it's like if you're eating Szechuan peppers and you kind of get that like hot or hot food, you get sort of high off of that. That's. For me, a particular kind of drama can do that. So I love Pachinko's story.
The TV show I was trying to remember is Kim's Convenience.
Okay. I don't think I saw that.
It was a comedy. It was on the CBC.
Okay.
And it was a Korean family, Korean immigrants. And oftentimes, the Korean dad would complain about Japanese versus Korean. So that's something that would have come up. But as you pointed out, it was shortly after he made that comment where she decides to like shoot everybody. And then how she just nonchalantly says, I'm hungry. Let's go eat.
Exactly. Like it's just, oh. And his reaction in that scene, he's just like, and then he has to kill the last guy.
Right.
Wild.
And I think he was justifiably angry because he did almost get shot.
Yeah.
Once they realized that, oh, they were being set up to be assassinated.
Yeah. And I think that's something to play forward from that a little bit is there are so many times in an episode, especially if it was a slower paced or lower keyed episode, where the tension of what's about to happen, like with the other John and Jane Smith or that one, or when they're in the Dolomites, where they're going through this relationship stuff and I'm just on the needle pin because I'm just waiting for an explosion to happen, for an assassin to burst in the door towards the end with the breakup stuff with, or actually it's in episode 7. I forget the woman's name, the other spy.
Oh, Michaela Cole.
Yeah. Like, you know, there are so many moments where you're constantly on edge, but nothing's going on. But the threat of violence or the potentiality is building and building and building in that sort of Hitchcockian way where what's going to trigger and release all of this energy that's winding up in the system and what's going to trigger it and then spring out and then what's going to happen. And I loved that they were able to keep me on the edge of my seat every episode. I was just biting my nails, nervous about, you know, what is it going to be? What's going to set things off?
I absolutely agree with you. I think they did that really well in the double date episode.
Yeah.
Because
oh my God,
the whole time they were eating that dinner. First of all, I was nervous when the Wagner Moura character.
Yes, he's so
even
good.
Met him in the first place. There was something.
Wait, you just like, don't meet another John.
Right. You just don't meet another John. So what's going on? So there was that. And then during the dinner, the whole time, like, are they telling them too much information? Yeah, or they're showing them too much? And then when they say they're going to go on this adventure or this job with them, and the looks on their faces when they realize that they're being set up to do the job themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Was.
And the way that the show then would drop these little things that then played out later on, little clues, little hints, little things like the very first opening scene is telling us the end of the show.
Oh, you're right.
Because
you're
they're right. killing. That's right. That's Wagner and what's her
we
name?
We can Parker assume Posey. It is.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. That's
we
that's
don't what, know for sure, but that's what it seems like. Yeah.
But regardless of whether it's the actual, you know, but it's telling us this was another John and Jane, and they're being killed by another set of assassins.
Absolutely,
that's what's coming in, and so the whole time they're building these little things and dropping these little clues and hints that actually play significant roles later on with the resolution of the whole plot.
Yeah, for sure. Before we move on from the marriage counseling episode, I wanted to bring up that fight during the camp scene, because I think that's that's the scene that stands out. It's so raw. It's so raw, and it's so and for me was one of the laugh out loud moments.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's talking about like everything he did, like he caught fish, whatever, he built a fire, and she's like, "Oh, me big caveman, me build fire." Like just the way it fell on me was so funny, but the height at which, like, the things they were saying, way they were saying it felt so real. The way that she was coming at him and his mom, the way he was saying, you don't have the ability to have a relationship with somebody. Just like the kind of things that people who really care for each other knows they would know not to say in normal circumstances. And they know that they're the kind of things that you can never take back. And like those are some like the worst kind of arguments you can have someone when you say something to someone you love dearly, the kind of thing that hurts more than even some. Like a gunshot wound, and you know you can never take it back. I feel like that argument rose to that level.
When you let go and let the hate flow through you.
Yeah.
And you let the lightning bolts out of your hands, and you say that thing that, and it feels so good in the moment of the heat. You're like, yeah, I'm going to stab you right back. And like, oh, wait a minute. That was probably, you know, a day or two later, like, maybe I shouldn't have, that was not a good idea. Yeah. And it was very real.
No, absolutely. The Gottmans. I'm a fan of the Gottmans, which is he's a famous marriage. He and his wife are a famous marriage counselor, and they studied married couples for like three decades. He and his partner, and then from that they were able to actually successfully predict how many couples would stay together, how many married couples stay together. And one of the things he talks about are the four horsemen of the apocalypse of a relationship. Okay. Mm-hmm. And one of them is contempt. And I think
we
see that in that fight. And in their relationship in general, we see that building up.
Well, and then the way that she's relating to him from a work standpoint, where he's saying, you're always taking the credit, and she's whatever her drive to.
Yes.
She has contempt for him.
Yes.
And he feels that. He can feel that sliding every time. So.
Absolutely.
Guest stars. The John Turturro episode.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, after I watched that, I was watching in bed on my laptop, and my wife is like, she ended up watching with me. And I was just like, what the hell did I just watch? Like, John Turturro directing, you know, sort of weird psychosexual things.
I can't remember where I heard it, but someone said something along the lines like, super rich people like creepy sex stuff.
Right.
Which is definitely.
It's a mythology that we have, right?
Yeah.
What goes on beyond with those.
Is it a mythology, though, Dan?
I don't know
if it's a myth. I think we have enough evidence where there's.
I think everybody is weirdly sexual in their own.
You can make that argument.
It's not about money.
Everyone has their little kinks for sure.
Exactly.
I don't know how many people have a kink of wanting to literally play dog right. and lick each other as a way of kissing.
And the double stab of the truth serum.
Which I thought was a great foreshadowing. I don't know if it technically was a foreshadowing, but how in the finale.
Okay, yeah.
Where the truth serum comes up and you're wondering, we know that anyone getting two at once is going to die.
Right.
And then so he makes you wonder in the finale, if that's how he's going.
But that's what I mean about these little things, these little devices, little things that they place throughout the, so they have a vision of the entire season.
Right.
And they construct little things that are innocuous at the time.
Right.
But then play a really important role at the end. So,
yeah. We'll say that for later when we talk about the finale.
Yeah.
But, you know, back to guest stars. So like John Turturro, and I'm pretty sure, except for the first episode, I think every episode has some kind of special guest star.
Right. The Ron Perlman was, I think, my favorite guest star appearance, maybe next to the John Turturro, because it was so recognizable as a parent.
Right.
He is their baby.
He's like their baby. Absolutely.
And when he kicks him off the little roof, I've done that. Like when my daughter, the first time she wanted to go, you know, we were going to go sledding with friends, right? And this is sort of during the pandemic and we're at the perfect hill on this little sled, perfect light. And she gets all set and she froze.
Right.
And I just tapped the sled with my foot and sent her down the hill. And then she came running back up. She was like, I'm going again. And from that moment on, she was, you know, a big fan of doing the sledding. But I kind of felt that in that same, it's different, but it's the same thing where it's just like, get over it, go, you'll be fine. You know, I can see it. You can't, you're not hearing me saying that it's going to be fine. So I just got to push you a little bit.
Yeah, no, perfect analogy in terms of their discussion. And when, and the scene where they're getting hot and heavy and they're about to go at it. And then he knocks on the glass and interrupts them again, like so total good. Kid move to do. Mom and dad are trying to have a moment. And
then the coercion, you know, you can have a cigarette if you do this thing.
Right. He never planned.
Right. And bribery, right? Bribery was at three, 4 years old. We were constantly using bribery as a, you know, as a tool to like get through something or get to the next thing. So as a parent, I felt really seen by that episode.
Right. What are your thoughts about, so in that scene, they have to take him to a safe house.
Right.
The safe house has been compromised. And then they take him to this secret house. Again, another great relationship thing. He went out and bought a house without talking to his wife.
Yeah, right. But are you my wife?
Right. Right. Well, the fact that which establishes how much money they have.
Yes.
He can just buy a house.
Yes. In Lake Como.
Yeah. In Lake Como, which, you know, if I ever do retire, it's going to be at some Italian waterside town for sure. Mm-hmm. I've been to Lake Como and it's gorgeous.
Yeah. It's totally beautiful.
But your thoughts on, so I have a theory that the high, the secretization set them up and that whole thing was a test for them.
Interesting.
Like a test to see if they're ready to go to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
The test to see
how they deal with
how they deal with it, because for two reasons. One, that would explain how they were able to find his house, because that means they're obviously tracking the Ron Perlman character, because she even asked them, "How are you going to know where to meet us?"
We'll know.
So we know that they're tracking him.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to believe they're the ones who sent the killers to the house.
Okay.
And I noticed that the killers chasing them were driving Land Rovers, and everyone in the organization drives Land Rovers.
Interesting. Oh, that's a good pick. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So
sort of a corporate deal on the cars that they drive. One thing I wanted to mention really quick too on the high thing.
Yeah.
It was so very Severance for me. the weird corporation. Like, we don't really know what's going on. Right? Yeah, the TV show Severance. So I got like very Severance vibes from the whole high thing. I don't.
That's
think
you know what? I did not think about it at the time, but now that you mention that, I do get that feeling, because the sense of like they don't know who Hi-Hi is.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. They only communicate through this, you know,
and this weird and controlled portal. Yeah.
And even the chatbot has sort of like a retro look, because it uses like courier font. And so, yeah, good call on that. Good call on that.
And it, I think as much as the show is a examination of a relationship, it's also, it really braces the whole gig economy sort of thing, because that's, it's immediately recognizable if anybody has ever done gig work like that off of a website and stuff. You feel very much, oh, two fails left. Oh, I got a 4.5-star rating instead of a 5-star rating on TaskRabbit or whatever. You're like, oh man, that's just going to kill me now. I'm going to be like hosed. And you're always waiting for the next, you know, ping to get your job. So I thought just that modern seating it in that way really is, again, I think Glover and the whole, is it Francesca Sloan? All of them, the way that they constructed it, it's very identifiable as a modern cultural, all these modern cultural artifacts are there for us to pick up on.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other guest star that is worth talking about is Michaela Cole, the quote unquote other woman, but she's more than just another woman. We learn in that episode, she's actually a member of a rival spy organization.
Which is a great revolution. Revelation.
I can't help think of the Mad Magazine Spy versus Spy.
Yeah. But little pointy hat dudes. Totally.
Yeah, I love that. Growing up as a kid.
Yeah.
But so one, I thought that was a cool revelation. But even the revelation of how the Jane character was hurt and the things that he revealed to the Michaela Cole character that he didn't do to Jane, like the fact that he changed his perfume when she mentioned that it made her sick, but he never did that for Jane. The fact that it's a job that was supposed to technically last 3 days has gone on for a month. I think we're starting to see Jane not only feel jealous, but also more than jealous, feel hurt. Because I think they established that in doing their jobs, they would sometimes have to have sex with other people.
Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I get the impression that that doesn't bother her. But he had a connection with Michaela Cole that was beyond just the physical. And I think it's a combination of him being able to be more himself with her.
Totally.
And I also think, even though it's not really brought out as much, I think maybe from Jane's point of view, she wonders if it's not a racial thing as well. Because we know that she is feeling like he sees her as a white girl.
Right.
That comes out in the finale. And we know that, you know, she commented on the racist comment he made about her being low-key Korean, because she specifically brings that up in the marriage counseling episode. So it makes you wonder if she's feeling like there's some of that going on too. Like, is that why he connects more with her than me?
And the way I was reading it was, you know, beyond the fact that does Bev know that John is a rival assassin? You know, I love the mystery and the onion shape around it. But the fact that he can sit with her and be himself in a way and have his not sexual needs met, but his social needs met and an understanding where he feels appreciated, where Jane is never appreciating him. Right. She's always emasculating him. She's always critiquing him or always sort of cutting him down. And after a while, that starts to hurt, right? Those things start to turn into bruises. And then when those bruises get bumped again, it hurts even more. And so for him to be able to go and sit with somebody who may have a similar perspective because of skin color, because of the way that we code race in this country,
Right.
He has an immediate identification with her, mm-hmm. saying we can relate without mm-hmm. having to talk about it. We can mm-hmm. just be in each other's presence without deconstructing or explaining the entire racial history of chattel slavery in this country or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
They can just be together and easy in each other's preferences. The irony is that they're both, you know, murdering assassins for right. rival. So it takes that comfort level even to the next step, which we don't even know until the big reveal. And then the way that they reveal the fact that he's like, where's my wife? Right. And the fact that then they're all spies was just a brilliant way to heighten the tension of that three-way scene.
Right. In my headcanon, I think Bev knows he's a spy.
Interesting. Okay. All right.
She almost has no reaction mm-hmm. when he says, where's my wife?
Right.
Her reaction to Jane pulling the gun on her.
She's very cool.
And maybe she's cool just because that's how she is as an assassin right. herself. But
I when she pulled a gun, I was like, oh, this is just a civilian. Like, you know, and she breaks the teapot.
Right.
You know, intentionally, accidentally, who knows? But I'd be like, you know, I'd be a bundle of nerves if somebody pulled out a silence pistol on me.
Right. And I love her line. To be clear, we're not friends. You're holding a gun on me.
So good. That was so good. So good.
The other line I love from that dialogue was when she's explaining to Jane what John has admitted.
Yeah.
And she says,
yes, yes.
You know, she asks, you know, you know, he says you're not compatible, but he would rather be with you incompatibly. I thought the writing was just beautiful.
Yeah.
So
touching, really touching.
And since we know that they're rival organizations, I have to believe the rival organization knows almost as much about what's happening with High High's organization as High High knows with their organization. So maybe it was kind of like a two-way thing going on.
Right.
Where they know that each other are spies, but they're enjoying their company so much that they don't want to.
Yeah, that's interesting.
This is interesting theory. But again, I thought that episode was another beautiful example of the mix between relationship drama and action. You know, because the chase afterwards, the way it plays out, even how during the chase they're having an argument. You know, like they're having this very traditional, typical spousal argument while chasing down this killer.
Whenever we would encounter somebody, or if we had friends, somebody who was getting married, I would say my unasked for, I guess not advice, but maybe observation is your relationship is in the way that you construct your wedding ceremony and all of your nuptials. And who you are as a couple is encapsulated in that process of deciding how you're going to take, you know, to set up your wedding ceremony, whether it's a big thing, a small thing, you know, who's planning what and how important are the colors. So the fact that the spy couple is running down the street chasing another assassin and they're having that argument, it's their relationship is right there. And that's what I love about the show is that doing inverting the normal with the extra normal.
Yeah.
So and I think this is another one of your bullet points, and I think it's a good segue, which is I think my frustration with the show was that we didn't get to do this for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Where we would get to deconstruct and break down every episode and go over the nuance of it. Instead, we have to sort of squeeze it. We have to compress it into an hour. And I don't know why the distribution was done that way. They could have owned 6-8 weeks of television.
Four. Like I think this is the kind of show where you definitely would have had to drop the first two at once.
Fair.
Yeah, because I feel like that first one was
slow.
Not enough action to keep people who would have come to the show for the action. Because at the end of that first episode, when the bomb goes off,
oh my god,
it's such a surprise.
I know that house. We used to walk by that house all the time. Yeah.
Oh,
did
they really blow it up?
No.
Yeah, no, I'm joking.
But that house has been used in a number of different movie sets. And for a while, it was really run down and they had not parts of it had some serious problems. And then we remember that they did a big movie shoot there. And then after that, they got it all fixed up. And then I think from then on, they were on the sort of radar because that part of Brooklyn, which is south of Prospect Park, it's called Ditmas Park. It's all houses and tree-lined streets and houses. And so if you're shooting in New York City and you need a neighborhood with a house, that's where you go. And so our neighborhood was constantly, and we had, you know, parking is terrible to begin with. It's just during the summer, man, weeks after weeks of displacement because they're filming in your neighborhood is really annoying. Anyway, side track.
There. Yeah, no worries. Yeah, so I think I could even see them dropping two episodes a week. But if they did, even if they did the first two the first week and then, and the episodes are long enough, they're like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And if they did one episode a week thereafter, they could have owned Thursday night or whatever for 7 weeks. And I feel like it would have drawn people in. I think it would have
our cottage industry of well, absolutely. It's not even a cottage industry when you think of like The Ringer or THR or Vanity Fair. They all have big ones as well. So
Amazon is strange that way in terms of what they choose to drop all at once, what they choose not to.
It's crazy. So let's talk a little bit about the final episode. Oh my lord. The acting, the level of acting of playing under that truth serum that they did. And to do that take after take, shot after shot, reset after reset, to maintain that continuity of I'm drunk on this weird truth-telling serum. Mm-hmm. And I'm going through different phases of up and down and it's hitting me and now I'm leveling out. And all of the revelations, I couldn't believe what I was watching. I was absolutely astonished at the level of acting that was going on in that.
Yeah. And I felt like that scene was a culmination of so many little inserts and so many nods of the head and tips to their relationship that they planted throughout the whole season.
Yeah.
Because one, you know, the double truth serum, so I remember watching that scene for the first time, wondering if he was going to shoot her. You can see it in her face. She's worried that that is what he's going to do, that she, that he's going to give her a double dose.
And that's it. He's going to stay sober and he's
And then she's going to die. So one, the fact that we see him do it to himself, but then we know that this is the first time where they're going to be 100% honest with each other.
Amazing.
In a way that they never have before.
Yeah.
And the things that come out in there during that time, I thought was, you know, really powerful. I love the fact that they admit that, and I think this comes out later, but at some point they admit that they had a shot on each other, but purposefully missed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I even remember thinking specifically during the scene where one of them is running up the steps and the other is shooting and the bullets are trailing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how are you missing?
Yeah.
You're supposed to be. And then the fact that they said, you know,
and they're at the peak of their skills
at this point.
Totally. Right. At this point, they are, they're expert.
So I love that little nugget, like, oh, that's kind of cool, because that definitely hit me. Like, how are they? Because that was one of my frustrations with the movie. Mm. That scene where there's this big shootout at the end and all the bad guys are missing them, despite the fact they have no cover.
Right.
And but in this TV show, so I love that. I love that that little nugget. But again, you know, the things that they admitted and how they admit it, and then using that scene to admit the fact that they weren't the ones that tried to kill each other.
Yeah.
Which they thought.
And the tension of waiting for them to reveal, to make that reveal that, I didn't do that. And so all that hurt and that pain that they've been shoving at each other, killed my cat and you tried to blow up my mom. Those are deep wounds, right?
Right.
And the fact that you're just like, just say it.
I was feeling the same way.
And then finally you're like, oh my Lord, you know, like when that relief comes. And then we learn that the other John and Jane are, of course, you know, the perpetrators behind that.
And I thought it was so funny when they were still under the serum and they asked them, are there any more other weapons? And they're saying, yes, and there's one over here, there's one over there, and there's one. That seems funny. One thing that confused me in that scene was when John 2 is about to sneeze.
Yes.
And they use that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
To shoot.
Which is another one of those little things that they set up earlier on the season.
But where did R. Jane get the gun to shoot?
Was it under the table? I don't remember. I'd have to watch that scene again.
Because I've already seen the show twice, but I wanted to see it again with my girlfriend.
Yeah.
But that was the only little thing I remember. Was it in the
flower pot or something? I can't remember.
Right. But yeah, having John and Jane there. And it's kind of funny that John and Jane too, and Parker Posey and Wagner Moura were so good in those roles.
And they're playing sort of arrogant, highfalutin, but we're really fun, casual people, but we're not,
Exactly.
Just their smarminess was delicious and
it was sort of fun. I love that. I love how you described it.
Did you ever see did you ever watch Narcos?
I did. Oh my gosh.
Because I didn't recognize that Wagner Moura was the original. Who's the drug king?
Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, Pablo Escobar. Because he really embodied that role.
with the weight, for sure. So it's funny because he's going to be in Civil War.
Oh no, really?
Yes, he's in Civil War. And I remember when I saw the trailer for Civil War.
Such a weird show to be coming out at this time.
Well, it's a movie.
Oh, wait, sorry. Yeah, movie. I don't know how I feel about it.
I know. It's going to be
interesting. And it's A24, so it's not going to be like a low budget thing.
It's going to be good. It's going to be. But I remember seeing him and thinking that I thought he was, the guy in Last of Us?
Pedro Pascal.
Pedro Pascal.
Yeah.
When I first saw him, I thought it was Pedro Pascal. He looks night and day from his Pablo Escobar character.
Yeah. Did you ever see the film that he was in called Elite Squad?
I've never seen him in anything other than Narcos.
That, if you ever happen to catch that, that's a really good movie. It's really intense. It's about Brazilian prison
stuff.
So yeah, it's really good. So where are you at with the finale? It's kind of a Rorschach test, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they obviously did it in a way where if this is the only season of television.
Right. Perfectly ended.
It's a great ending.
Three shots, so we don't really know.
And the fact
that they thought about how many shots.
Yeah.
One shot, we're going to think this. Two shots, we're going to think that. Three shots. No idea. No clue.
And the fact that the third shot, if you go back, third shot is there's a pause between the third shot and the second shot.
Yes.
So the first two shots are off quick and it's the third shot. So in my head canon, they get away and the first two shots are the Parker Posey character shooting quickly when the door opens.
Okay.
And Jane is ducking or something. And the third shot is Jane's kill shot.
Right.
That's my head.
I like that. I was thinking that maybe she would also be Maya Jane got wounded. It would be wounded. So they're both wounded and they're both in a bad way, but that they did get away. That's sort of where I'm at.
What about the Paul? We haven't talked about Paul Dano the whole time. He has the great reveal in the finale. So one, I love.
I forgot about it. This is why I'm frustrated with the show. Well, with Amazon, because we didn't get a time to unpack all of these different characters and all these subplots.
Yeah, right. I kind of feel like he's cast against type as the hot neighbor. Like, I never thought of Paul.
He was very doughy.
Right. I never thought of Paul Dano as hot. Right?
No. Right.
I mean, but I think In this series, he has a sort of suave, debonair-esque to him you're not so sure.
I'm not so sure.
All right.
Because I kind of know who he is from the neighborhood that he's living in. So I'm kind of like, you're not hot. You're just, you got too much money and you don't deserve it. You're kind of
But I love the fact where he says, you know, I'm an agent. And the first time he says he is an agent, and then you realize, oh, he's a real estate agent. He's a
real estate agent.
Right.
And then they end this, don't they end the whole series on the fact that he's like, yeah, we're going to get it for a good price or whatever.
Right. So he was, I think that was a fun ending, fun reveal.
Yeah.
So if they were to bring the show back, what would be your hope? Would your hope, because there have been kind of conversations that it could easily be a, something similar to how a White Lotus is an anthology series where each season could be a different John and Jane story. Mm-hmm. If they brought one, do you want it? Do you feel like this is enough? You feel like there's a good ending? Do you want to see it come back? Where do you stand on that?
I would like to see it come back maybe for 3 seasons total so that we've got a nice beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And I really think I would like a plotting the trajectory of relationship from that young love, no kids, kind of your early, you've got your jobs, you're in the city, you're whatever you're doing. And then at some point, what I would love season 2 to be is your middle ages, right? You're settled down. Everything's sort of automatic. Maybe they do have one kid, right? Or whatever they negotiate out.
Right.
And so much of your life is just in getting the kid out the door and getting them home and fed and bathed and making sure that the mortgage is paid and all that kind of stuff. And then examining that and then looking then at a third season being the golden years of life where, the kids are gone and you're in sort of quasi retirement and, you get to have some fun in some ways, or, you're just looking at life in a different way. I think that would be a really great model to stick with, because if it's not Maya Erskine and Donald Glover, what's the show? Mm-hmm. I get White Lotus as an anthology, and we've covered the season 2, and we're going to cover season 3 when it comes back. And that's fine for that. But for this show, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, it's Glover and Erskine for me. And if they're not there, then I would have you'd have to do some work to get me to watch it.
Yeah. I can feel you. I think if, like, one, me too, I would love to see Donald and Maya come back.
Yeah.
To know what happened to them, I think they would have to be on the run. They failed 3 times.
Interesting.
They would
that's a good point. I forgot about that.
Yeah, they failed 3 times.
And they killed the top tier high risk John and Jane.
So it could be about them. I could see like a season. I like your whole idea of 3 seasons. I could see season 2 being on the run and a season 3 of them trying to get to the organization.
Okay. All right. Take it apart or get to the center. Just
finding out who Haya is and whatnot.
Right.
I think one of the things that would be complicated is there's no way the organization is not going to take out John's mom. In order to draw him out.
They took out the cat, so they got to take out the mom.
Yeah. Like, there's no way they're going, like, if he is on a run.
Yeah.
Knowing how connected he is to his mom, there's no way they're not using his mom to bring him back in some way. So they'd have to deal with that storyline.
So that would be an interesting show too. They just pick up like almost immediately right after the ending of this one, rather than say years ahead.
Or it could be some time ahead and it's kind of a mystery. It could be a mystery as to what's happened to the mother. I could see them having a kid. We could see them off the grid somewhere.
So many different directions, couldn't they?
Right.
We really do have it wide open.
Just knowing how Glover and Francesca Sloan are, I think anything that we conceive, they're not going to do.
Exactly.
Like anything we can predict, they would probably know that people are going to predict that.
Yep.
And they would go off in some other kind of direction. Those type of creators, if they get it.
And that's what I want from a show like this, is to be surprised and delighted. Yeah. And I was surprised and delighted at every episode and every twist and everywhere that this thing went. I could have never predicted it. And that's what was so enjoyable, because every episode I was sitting down, I'm going to go, okay, what fresh craziness have they cooked up for us in this episode? Mm-hmm. And when Ron Perlman turns out to be their baby, I was like, I cannot believe what I'm watching here. This is fantastic. Or when they go to the therapist, all of it is beyond imagination.
Yeah. I can see the Ron Perlman character being high up in the high organization.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because they said he's an important asset.
Yeah.
He talked about the horrible things he's done in his life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can see him coming back for that. I would love to learn a little bit more. I could see a season two being about because Michaela Cole is such an amazing actor. Mm-hmm. You know, the Did You Destroy Me or I will destroy you. Ever since that came out, people have just talked about how amazing, how captivating she is in terms of how she captures the screen. I could see season two being about her, how she came up, how she grew up.
That could be fun.
Maybe she came from the streets of London, because I think she's a British actor.
Well, that would be fun too. Yeah, we could pivot away from Glover and Erskine and be with somebody else until their paths cross and then pick up again.
Totally.
That would be great.
I see that. I think that would be interesting. It could be interesting seeing how the John and Jane 2, how they got back together. Mm-hmm. I think there are certain people and characters they introduced in this one that it would be interesting to see. If I were to build a whole season around anyone, it would be the Michaela Cole character.
Okay.
In terms of how she got trained. A spinoff. I can totally see how she got trained or whatever.
Another IP franchise, right? Yeah, yeah. There we go.
But awesome. I do hope it comes back in some form, because I think I'd be disappointed if Maya and Donald didn't come back because that chemistry was so palpable. But I would trust that if Donald is involved and they came back, it's going to be something that is going to be worth the watch.
His sensibilities and the crew of writers that they have around them have a particular sensibility that, you can just trust that it's going to be good.
Right. And I could see Phoebe Waller-Bridge having a guest star appearance.
Okay. That'd be fun. That'd be a nice thing to do. Yeah.
Rather than if she wasn't a co-creator. So those are my thoughts.
Awesome.
Fingers crossed.
Well, a really enjoyable season of television. I am looking forward to seeing what they come up with next.
Me too.
Cool. All right. Well, let's wrap it up here. Just really quick, if you are listening to this and you think, wow, this is, Lorehounds, a lot of fun stuff, and you are interested in participating, you're just welcome to listen on the public feeds. We have the Discord if you want to jump on. Again, we've got a good moderator team on there and channels for all the different projects that we're doing. And if you feel like you want to take a step a little bit further, then we have our Patreon or our Super Chat. There's links in the show notes for those. And just know that this is a big work of passion that we're doing. So this isn't a commercial venture for us in that regard. It's about community. And so if you want to support the community at large, we have a lot of different co-hosts and obviously all the software and the things that we have to, all the tools that we have to have to produce a podcast. That's where all your support goes. Really quick, we do have a couple of other podcasts that we sponsor. We've got Woolshift Dust. Alicia has had a rough start to the year, but she'll be back soon, hopefully with some Dune coverage before long. I know she's got plans there. And a few other things. We've got Properly Howard Movie Review, and Anthony and Steve are on a little bit of a break, but they'll be back. And then speaking of Severance, we're going to be covering season two with them. The four of us are going to do week-to-week coverage. We're just waiting. And we've just launched a new podcast, Rings and Rituals, with Marilyn R. Pakila, who's our favorite Tolkien scholar, and then her colleague, Dr. Sarah Brown from Signum University. They're going to be looking at season one of Rings of Power, looking at all the rituals that we see take place on screen. They're going to be examining those and exploring where those come from in the Legendarium. But they're also going to use that as a way to look at ritual in our own daily lives and the kinds of things that we do to create ritual and what ritual gives us as human beings and the sort of mythology making storytelling creatures that we are. So that first episode should have already been out by the time that this podcast will be published. But again, there's a link in the show notes below. For the Lorehounds proper, we just wrapped up True Detective.
We're just going to be starting with Shogun. We've got our next chapters in the Earthsea, Ursula K. Le Guin series of books. We're reading Dragonfly and the first chapter of The Other Wind. We're continuing with Silmarillion stories. We're continuing with our Star Wars Film Festival. Masters of the Air, we're going to put an end cap podcast once the season is over. Have you been watching that at all, Ron?
I have not.
Okay.
I have no interest in watching.
Okay, good. Fair enough. It's mixed. It's mixed. It's interesting. But and then we've got dates for The Acolyte and The Boys. That's going to be coming out. It's going to be a hot summer. And I'm just waiting for when House of Dragon is going to be released, because it's probably, if it's all going to be in June, we're going to have a hell of a time.
Is the next season of Boys this summer?
Yep. They've released the date already. I got to look it up here on the show tracker, but it's in June. Along with The Bear as well. So The Acolyte starts June 5th, The Boys starts June 13th, and The Bear starts sometime around June 20th. We don't have an actual date for the Bear, but they have always released it at the end of June. So, and if Hot D comes out, we're going to be a 4x coverage. It's going to be crazy.
They're going to be fighting for the top of my list after Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yes, it's going to be a big year. Okay, so final shout outs to our supporters, to our Discord server boosters, Opus the Machine, Gnarls, and Aaron K. and Tiller the Thriller. Oh, also, who else? Somebody who just boosted us today. Who was that? I think that was, Dork of the Ninjas. Thanks for all of your guys' support for that. For our Lore Masters, our top tier subscribers are Samartian, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa, Andra B., Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V., Aaron T., Sub-Zero, Aaron K., Dally V21, Gnarls, and always last but never least, Adrian. Thank you all so very much for your support as Lore Masters, our top-tier subscription. Ron, that about wraps it up. Thanks very much. Where can people find you if they want to track you down on the interwebs?
Yeah, just go to Blurred Ronner. Like Blade Runner, but Blurred, B-L-E-R-D, Ronner, R-O-N-N-E-R.com. And that takes you to all the different things, Dungeons and Durags, my podcast, and my social medias and everything else.
And we don't have any specific plans for you to be back on the Lorehounds, but I have no doubt that we're going to find some crossover somewhere to have you back on. And if you've got any ideas, any shows that you want to, come at us, you've got an open invitation on the microphones over here. Anytime. Wait,
anytime you throw up a bat signal, I'll be looking out for it. And I'll come on by.
Very good. All right. Thanks again. We'll talk to everyone later.
Thanks, everybody.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the Roaring Twenties. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.